that's where I felt safe. So I needed to figure out how to train, how to start moving my body in a way. I started from the bottom before. Mm-hmm. How can I get strong enough and take care of my body and train going forward in a way that's going to honor my nervous system where it is at any given moment?
Welcome to the Permission to Heal podcast. I am Marcy Brockman. Together, we will discover what brings us meaning and true joy. You only need your own permission to begin. Welcome to season two. I'm really excited that you're here. Permission to Heal took 6 weeks off around the holiday season to rest and recharge and reprioritize and heal and do some self-care and visit with family. And unfortunately, we all got COVID, so we were getting over that as well as a family. But now we are back. Permission to Heal has a lot of really amazing, inspirational guests lined up for season two, and I'm excited to get started. Happy New Year, everyone, and let's begin. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Laura Kudari from New York City. Laura is the author of the new book, Lifting Heavy Things, Healing Trauma One Rep at a Time. Laura is passionate about giving people the tools they need to heal from trauma and cultivate mental health and wellness. Her approach to strength training restores the nervous system health, fosters a sense of safety in the body, and provides adjunctive support to people processing trauma so they may move beyond surviving and to begin to thrive. Her work has been widely recognized by the trauma and fitness community. She is a trauma practitioner, certified personal trainer, and corrective exercise specialist. Her holistic educational programs draw from body-based trauma healing modalities, neuropsychological models, psychodynamic theory, mindfulness practices, and exercise science. Laura's practice grew out of her own experience healing from trauma, not just in therapy, but on the gym floor too. She works with clients all around the world and lives in New York City with her family and two cats. Hi, Laura. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am excellent. Excellent. Nice. Thank you. Nice. So we're finally together. We rescheduled and rescheduled and rescheduled and
now is the
here.
Time.
That's awesome. It just wasn't meant to be before. So we're both in New York, I think, right? You're in the city?
I'm in the city. You're on Long Island?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Very close. Very close. So we usually begin the episodes with the six quick questions, gets us off and running. What six words would you use to describe yourself?
Grounded.
Grounded.
Stubborn.
Good.
Warm. Mm-hmm. Maternal. Creative. Anxious.
Okay.
I think, is that six?
Yes.
Those were the first six that popped into my mind.
Excellent. Why was six with a question? You went up at the end. Anxious?
Anxious? I don't know. I usually, I'm anxious. No.
Damn it, I'm anxious. You caught me.
I feel like that didn't go with the, you know, the other ones, but they do go well, because that's all me.
We're all varied. I mean, anxiety and stubbornness can go together. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
You know, absolutely. Yeah. I think some of the reasons were, or at least for me, I don't speak for anyone else. Some of the reasons I'm anxious is because I'm stubborn.
Oh, flipped. Stubborn because you're anxious for me, right? If you refuse to give in, feel safer.
Yeah. Could be. Who knows? Maybe. We could spend that. What's your favorite way to spend a day?
Oh, that varies. It really does vary.
Yeah, but it's a seasonal mood thing.
It's a seasonal mood thing. You know, in the summer, it's like being like a lizard, just like in the heat. I love that. This time of year, though, is much more cooking. I love to cook. I just really do. And spending time, it could be just like time really deeply connecting with my friends or my husband. Yeah.
I think that connection, that deep, comfortable, like cozy sweater kind of connection, not only feels wonderful, but I think feels even more wonderful considering the pandemic, you know, I just got together with my aunt and cousins and so on after not seeing them for 3 years. Wow. And they just live in Jersey. It's not that big of a deal. But between illnesses and life and then the pandemic and who's not vaccinated, and we were finally all vaccinated and booster shotted, booster vaxxed, however that goes, booster shot. I don't know.
I always say boosted.
Boosted. There you go. We were boosted and we finally felt safe enough to get together. And I did not realize how much my heart had missed that. So much more than just FaceTime or Zoom or text messaging, but to actually sit at a table and share a meal and be able to touch one another. And it was just extraordinary. Okay, question number three. What is your favorite childhood memory?
My childhood memory, I just have I have a handful, but I'll go with the first that popped in my mind when you asked.
Yes.
When I was a little girl, I would visit I was very close to my grandmother, Gloria, and I would visit her in her apartment in New York City. And it was a long pre-war, had like a long hallway.
Cool.
And the windows came pretty low and had very deep sills. So it was almost like they were all almost kind of like window seats for me as a kid.
Right. For small children or one tush. Right.
And I would like, you know, play on them. And like, in my mind, I imagined that the whole apartment, and I think a lot of kids play this kind of game, was the floor was all water. Uh-huh. And it was like a water city. And there were no cars, there were only boats, and the furniture and the sills were
nice.
And I would play like that for hours. I'm an only child, I'm an only grandchild. So.
Me too. Well, I was until I was in my mid-teens, but yeah.
Ah. And but what was kind of amazing was I told my grandmother about it, and she said, you know, there's a real place like that in Italy called Venice. I'll take you there. And she took me there.
Awesome. How old were you? Like nine?
I was nine.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you excited? You must have been thrilled.
Yeah, I'm still excited. I wish I would love to go back. I haven't been back.
Wow. Yeah. That's so cool.
I really remember so much of that trip. It was her and my mother. This was my mother's mother.
Yeah.
And me, three generations.
That's so beautiful.
It was a really nice
trip. I hope you have 1,000 photographs.
I do.
That's wonderful. When you were telling me about the windowsills and the water, I thought about something I hadn't thought about in a very long time. I used to sit upside down on my mother's couch in the living room so that my back was on the seat of the couch and my legs were up on the back of the couch on the wall so that my head was hanging over the edge where your legs normally are. And so my head was upside down.
Yep.
And I would stay that way for such a long time that my perspective would shift so that the floor would become the ceiling and the ceiling would become the floor. And then it looked like everybody was walking on the ceiling.
Right.
I used to love doing that. And my mother she was, why are you going to be dizzy? All your blood's rushing to your head. But, you know, I'm like 6, 7 years old. Who cares?
Right.
I hadn't thought about that in ages. Somehow your memory triggered that. Interesting. Yeah. Cool. Let's try number four. What is your favorite meal?
My favorite meal.
Or one of them.
Oh, I love to cook. I love to eat. So I'm feeling like totally okay. So what came into my mind, which is funny because I don't think this is true for me anymore, but I'll share it anyway. I guess I want to go to Italy because it was cacio e pepe. I went through a very big cacio e pepe.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, okay. It's a dish. It's where you have the hot pasta. The cacio is cheese, pepe is pepper. And they take the hot pasta and spin it through a carved out wheel of Parmesan while it's hot. So it gets all covered in the Parmesan and black pepper. And I mean, I haven't eaten that in a bajillion years. In that, I am making pasta tonight, but I wasn't planning to make cacio e pepe. But maybe I should.
Interesting. I'm not a pepper kind of person, except if it's like just used as one of the seasonings in something. Mm-hmm. But that cheese part—that's got me. I like that.
Yeah, There's a, if you come into the city, there is a restaurant called Cacio e Pepe in the East Village.
Ah.
You get yourself some there.
There you go. Will they do it just Cacio without the Pepe?
I don't know. You'll have to ask. Call ahead.
Hold the pepper.
I don't know.
Unless it's already pre-mixed in. Who knows? All right. Let's move on to number five. What is the one piece of advice you would like to give your younger self? Assuming your younger self would listen to you.
Right. Even if it's very uncomfortable, be true to yourself.
That's huge. Especially the even if it's very uncomfortable part. That resonates with me a lot. Deeply.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when we're kids, not when we're little kids, but when we're adolescents, kids, you know, it's healthy to want to start to find yourself in your peer group. So it would be very uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable to honor yourself while longing for acceptance, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was a little, very little kid, actually all through elementary school and probably middle school, was very shy. I had my friends, but it was a tight, small friend group, which was fine. I longed to be part of like the dramas and the musicals in high school. And I wanted to try out for solos and band and chorus. And I knew I had a good singing voice, but I was petrified. Right. And there was a moment my freshman year of high school where I realized that if I allowed myself to be ruled by my shyness, I would never experience this whole list of things that I wanted to experience. And I was unwilling to let the shyness win. Mm. And so it was like I had a talking to with myself, you know, like, if you say the thing, tell the joke, sing the song, whatever it is that you think you want to do that you hold yourself back from doing, if you do it, what's the very worst thing that could happen?
Right.
If they laugh at you, are you going to feel bad? If you don't get the part, if they walk away, if no one laughs at the joke, if they think you're ridiculous, is the earth going to swallow you whole? And when I realized that none of the catastrophe things were going to bother me as much as having to say what if and feeling bad about myself.
Right.
I said, screw it. I'm just going to do it. So I would say that your advice is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
I like that.
Hopefully, I don't know if I would listen to it though.
No, I don't know. Depends on the age. If I had gone back and said that to myself when I was 14, I would have said, okay, damn straight, I get it. But 11, probably not. Mm-mm. Middle school age? Middle school was terrifying. Absolutely not. Yeah. Absolutely not. Okay, number six. What is the one thing you would most like to change about the world? Yes, it's a small question.
Oh, well. I was talking actually with my mother earlier today. We were talking about the work I do. And it made me think of a question I got asked in an interview, my first interview for anything. I actually don't think the article ever even came out. And I was pretty new to the work, working with trauma. And the interviewer asked me, like, big picture, what did I see, like, in this work? And I was like, well, it sounds silly at first, but like, if we understood and dealt with trauma as trauma, if we understood what that meant and what it was, I think that we would see radical shifts in how policy is made.
Yeah.
And I mean, that makes huge sweeping changes in the world. And so I would like to see people, sort of the treatment of trauma, and when things come up for people, big things come up for people, and they may potentially be traumatized, that it was really normalized for us to grapple with it, because I think the implications could be tremendous in a really beautiful way for the world.
I absolutely 1,000% agree. And I'm starting to see little bits of that happening, you know, not grand sweeping national policy, But just as a little tiny thing, our school district, our particular school, I'm a high school English teacher by day.
Oh, okay.
And we had in the last year, three of our faculty members pass away from COVID. Mm. And the faculty was shocked, and there's going to be repercussions of that and all sorts of trauma, et cetera. And the student body, of course, you know, they're all teenagers and they all knew these teachers. And each of them is going through their own experience with COVID and their families and all the loss and burdens and difficulties, et cetera. And the school district was like, heard us say that we needed help. Mm. And they got a group called Project Hope to in over, you know, the course of several weeks and stay the whole day in one of the back conference rooms to meet with people and talk one-on-one, to do meditation, to do whatever modalities, breathing that they were doing. And I thought, finally, somebody is going to address what's sitting in our laps and not just try to look around it to continue along with the academics. Several years ago, that wouldn't have never happened. Maybe even before the pandemic, that would have never happened. I don't know. Mm-mm. I don't know. Pretty amazing. Okay. So let's get into it. I loved your book. Loved your book. Lifting Heavy Things. I
like thank you.
The whole feel of it, even. I like the cover. I read through the whole thing. I felt like I was sitting with you and we were having a chat. I wrote notes in the margins and all sorts of stuff. I'm not a weightlifter. And it's very intimidating. But after reading your book, I might try it.
You also, you know, don't have to do the lifting of weights. There, you can. I mean, you can.
Right.
I would, you know, but it talks about how to do it.
Well, I'm lifting my own body weight.
Pilates. So. I always say about Pilates, like I'm afraid. I get nervous doing Pilates, and I'm like, people are like, oh, you're so strong,
so
and
good.
I'm like, Pilates strong is like a whole other kind of strong. It's amazing to me.
And it's on one of those reformer.
The table. Reformer stuff.
Oh my God. Feels so good. Suddenly I'm walking better. Mm-hmm. Like my hip joints and my piriformis and all that whole system in there was so tight. I felt like I was waddling like an 80-year-old.
Sure.
And just a couple of sessions and I'm like, oh, my legs are like Gumby now, you know, it's heaven. Anyway, so let's talk more about this. So tell us all about your childhood, who you are, what young Laura looked like. How did you get to kind of where you are now? It's a huge question, but no one can tell it better than you.
No one can tell mine better than me. It's true. So yes, well, when I was very little, I lived on Long Island, and growing up, I moved around a little bit and was in Westchester and New York City, which is where I am now. I did leave for 10 years. I know some people don't ever leave. I did leave for 10 years and came back. And growing up, I was an artsy kid. I was often drawing. I did take dance classes until I was, I did dance classes at the local dancing school. My mom took me out when I was about 8, I think, because they were going to start having us do like traveling. And she was not into that. She didn't want me to be used as a prop for business, I think.
Right.
So, but I liked dance and would continue to dance, like put on Madonna records and mm-hmm. Michael Jackson records and dance in the living room.
That was me. I always thought that I was the most graceful. I was probably the biggest klutz ever. But in my mind, I was.
Absolutely.
You know, a nice dancing queen.
Yeah, absolutely. I know. I'm still like that. And I had a challenging adolescence. And in that time, I really didn't like associating with my body at all. Like I saw my body as my body kind of became an unsafe thing, right? Like I was picked on and eventually actually bullied for a year in one of the schools I was in middle school. And I was a little bit chubby. And that was some low hanging fruit, man. And people mm-hmm. would really use that in
people
in the bullying. And I, growing up, it was being thinness was really valued, right? Mm-hmm. And I was kind of normal, but for whatever reason, there was a big emphasis on the fact that my body wasn't this ideal, right? And then in the 90s, as a teenager, when it was, you know, Kate Moss.
Right.
Right. This little Jewish girl. Right. I was like, never going to happen, right? And right. That's when you desperately want to look like who's ever on the billboards, right?
Exactly.
And it just didn't feel also, you know, being in New York City by that age and walking around in high school in the body of a woman, being street harassment and that kind of thing felt unsafe. So there was just like a lot to not want to have to deal with. Like,
sure.
And I didn't like gym class. And so I would like cut to go smoke cigarettes in the park. That went much better with my image, right? Sure. Like art kid in the park, not
right. Do you do the goth sports. Thing too?
It was very grunge with a touch of goth, you know,
like more I did Nirvana, have, early 90s grunge.
Okay. I did have, I think my favorite was this like crushed velvet black maxi dress, which I always wore Doc Martin boots. And this was before they had the zippers, right? Uh-huh. So you know this, there were no zippers when we were young. Oh. Now they have zippers for easy on off. So the 14 eyelets.
Oh yeah, they do. My daughter has a pair with zippers. Yeah.
14 eyelets, lace it up, you know, the whole thing. So with the motorcycle jacket, it was a look.
A little older than you, but I had the same look. Yep.
And I just didn't, college, we have PE requirement, which I was like so put out by, but, you know, did some, whatever, got it over with. And it was
dance when and I ice skating for PE in college.
I did. Well, I did. That was self-defense, great. Self-defense for women.
Wait. Well, that's useful in the city.
Well, now I was at Mount Holyoke. So it was a bunch of women and some.
Okay.
I don't know, cows. So it is useful. It's a useful skill. Absolutely. And I actually did the weight room.
Oh, this good was, for you.
It was machines, but I was like, well, I always knew what that was thing. I always knew I was kind of strong, even though I didn't want to do anything with it. Mm-hmm. And what it was I thought of myself, even though I thought of myself as quite big. And, you know, we talked about, I'm stubborn, I'm mm-hmm. grounded. So I always felt I could like leverage my weight sure. against something else and move it. So I was like, well, I guess I'll lift weights. So that was one term. I did West African dance. That was fun.
Ooh, that's
so
fun.
Again, the dancing, right?
Yeah.
And then yoga, which would show up for me later on in life. When I was doing it then, it was very like, I want a nap, but...
Right.
It was fine. But it was also in college when my back went out for the first time. It went out. I was 20 years old and I was
you
getting up
about this in your book.
Yeah. I was getting up from a chair at my library job. So like, I think I say this in the book, like I wasn't even doing something cool. You know, right. I was about as nerdy as you can get.
Standing and, up in the library. Right.
Right. after doing data entry. So I get up and my back seizes and I am frozen.
Ugh.
And it's terrifying. And it's the summer. I stayed up there in the summer. So it was the summer and I had to get back to my apartment. And I could barely drive myself home. Eventually my mom saw me. She made me come back to the city and go see an orthopedist. He gave me a script for physical therapy and told me to start strength training. And I did the physical therapy and I was not going to go to the gym. Sorry. And I knew from physical therapy, the elliptical was like mm-hmm. enough to sort of like get by when it seized up. So I did the bare minimum. I did the PT. When my back would get really bad, I would use the health center at school, the fitness center. And I hobbled around in pain for 7 years.
What?
And I was like,
stubborn.
I'm not.
There you go.
I'm not doing this. I'm not. I had a lot of reasons, but I would say I felt I was, and this was all from all the stories that this narrative all came from all the things from before. I was too fat to go to the gym. I wasn't athletic enough to go to the gym. People will be mean to me at the gym. My body is bad. Mm-hmm. It needs to change. So it was all this like place of deficit, weakness, badness, problem.
Right.
So
like many women have that.
Right. I think it's really normal.
It teaches us to feel like crap so that we go and spend money on stuff.
I don't know how many times I've heard people say, I'm too fat to go to the gym. And fitness, people in fitness, the response is usually like, well, that's ridiculous. I'm like, well, actually, let's unpack.
It's not ridiculous.
It's not ridiculous. There's a reason. There are many reasons. And that could be its own podcast.
For me, the too fat that comes to the gym doesn't get expressed that way. For me, it's like, what am I going to wear for workout clothes? Like what clothing will I wear that I can move in and feel comfortable and feel covered enough to feel safe? Like when I was in my 20s, I wasn't all that fit, but I was thinner. Mm. So I could get away with leggings and a tank top or something. Like the stomach was still flat. But post babies, post menopause, it ain't flat anymore. And it's a little curvier than I'm comfortable with, but c'est la vie, you know, I'm working it. It is what it is at this moment. And so I need belly, like longer shirts or something. And like what? So to me, it shows up that way. Anyway, this is about you. Right. And
I know I get it. I was going to say my belly has never been flat. That was not for me a thing, but it was like, if people are going to see me, so I tried to disappear. So it was, what could I wear that no one would notice me, right? Mm-hmm. When I eventually did start showing up, which happens because my mom was like, I'm tired of looking at you walking around. I moved back to the city where she was. And she said, I'm tired of looking at you moving around like you're 70 years old. You're 27. I want you to meet my trainer. And I was like,
but I wanted a trainer. That's progressive. Yeah.
Yes. And she worked out so she could enjoy her life. This was not about vanity for her. It was about maintaining active. Health. She liked to ride her bike around the city, which in itself is kind of amazing.
And extremely dangerous. That would scare the crap out of me.
She just likes to be able to do things. And she's watching her friends lose the ability to bend over and tie their shoes. And she's like, I don't want to be like that. Yeah. It was an independence. She was doing it for like independence and to be able to enjoy herself. And
go mom.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. And she asked me to meet her trainer and I was like, ugh. But I knew I wanted to start a family and I knew I would have problems with pregnancy with my back. And also after I lived like in a walk up, like how is I going to walk up my
groceries
stairs
and a baby and a stroller and all that other stuff if you couldn't carry yourself up the stairs?
Exactly. So I acquiesced and I met her trainer. And we just really connected and we're very close. And he's currently writing my programs now. I've gone back and forth over time, but we're very good friends. And he created space for me to show up to this gym and take care of myself and not be too preoccupied with everybody else.
That's awesome.
And he honestly, he did it with like kindness. And also, I do think his nickname, his name is Ed. His nickname is Big Ed for a reason. He is actually like a wall. So he would physically create space in the gym. Right.
And no one was going to pick on you if you were with Big Ed the wall. Right.
Right. And he's so kind and well-respected and respecting of other people that actually that was like, so when people were around in the space, they were also more kind and respectful. So I kept showing up because my back started to stop hurting. And that was it.
That's a good motivator.
That was it. I was like, oh, and I liked my time with him. I hated doing the exercises, but my back stopped hurting. And I was like, okay. Right. And over time, I started to find, when I started to be able to like graduate to exercises, I deemed, you know, cool. Mm-hmm. So things with weights, I liked it more and more. It would be 8 years before I would point to people doing Olympic weightlifting and say, I want to do that. So that was when I was 34. And that was when the shift from like, so it was like, no, then begrudgingly. And then like, okay, I guess I'll do this. To, oh my God, you cannot keep me away. And that's so that's awesome. When I actually, so I was 34 when I fell in love with anything that had anything to do with the gym. And it was really empowering. And it was so right. So I was like, everything was about deficit, my bad back, the way my body looked. Like I wasn't fast. That's something I'm still not particularly fast. Now we're focusing on, I'm strong. I can get stronger. I have the ability to grind, right? Just in general in my life, when there's a lot of pressure, I can keep going. Mm-hmm. Strength sports really play to that. Right.
Right.
So I was really embracing all these things about me. A desire to be subversive, right? The goth girl, the kid who cut class to smoke in the park.
Right.
Well, a woman, a middle-aged lady doing Olympic weightlifting before CrossFit got really big, especially, uh-huh. That's subversive, right? So it's like,
right. Oh, I'm cool.
There was no other women in this gym.
You're badass, just Laura.
Exactly. That's why I was like, it looks cool, right? You know, right. So these were playing to my strengths. And I just, that was kind of how that unfolded.
Nice.
Becoming a trainer and a coach, that was like never on the radar, but that, I just love that.
Can we stop for half a second? How did you transition from weightlifting to help your back feel better to realizing that weightlifting helped you deal with trauma?
Yeah. After I fell in love with the sport of weightlifting and after 8-9 years of being in the gym and feeling so empowered, I experienced an acute trauma outside of the gym.
Okay.
And subsequently developed PTSD. And it was a journey from there because actually I turned the gym from something that was empowering, right? So I wanted to feel invulnerable now. So it was actually became something that was beautiful and empowering to something that became maladaptive. And I was training and training and training and training. And I trained 10 times a week. I trained wow. Olympic weightlifting, powerlifting, and karate.
Wow.
All aggressive. No steady state cardio, which I'm a big proponent of for recovery, no yoga, no sleeping, right? I have PTSD. I'm not really talking about it with people, but I am not sleeping anymore. I am also restricting my food to be able to put on more muscle and get stronger and faster, but I'm actually not. I'm taking terrible care of my body.
Right.
But I didn't understand any of that. And fitness culture is all about especially this kind of where I was in, it was very like, oh, look at her determination. Look at how thin she's getting. It's the only time in my life I was ever slim. I was like really jacked. I was showing up no matter what. I was pushing through pain. And these are all really celebrated in that world.
Even and though they are half not of what you're doing is detrimental to your health, right?
It's not health and wellness. It's like some other thing. And my back, it came full circle and my back went out, and it went out so severely. It was terrifying. I lost the capacity to use my left lower leg much. Like I wow. couldn't point and flex my foot. So it really limited my gait, and it made my whole back seized up again. Like my job in the library, here I am, I'm constricted. I can barely move. And I've been training to feel safe and invincible. And now I can barely walk. Okay. So I am terrified.
You probably felt betrayed by your own body.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't know how long of a time it was. I was in bed a lot. I was going to the doctor and getting injections, going to PT. Everything felt invasive. And I knew it was all, everything was tied up with the trauma, right? I was in therapy at the time also. So I was doing talk therapy, but we are like at the top of everything. Like it's going to be a journey.
We're at the beginning. The surface, you mean, not really getting into anything deep. Is that what you mean?
Well, it was a mess. It wasn't that we weren't trying. There was just so much to unpack.
Okay.
And I was in therapy 3-4, sometimes 5 days, if I could see her 5 days.
Wow. That's
it was. And I, cause I, but I was just, my therapist was the only place. Now I didn't have the gym anymore. So my therapist was the only place I felt yeah. safe. And I connected the things, and I was like, there's gotta be a book on this. And I was looking for a book called Healing Back Pain by John Sarno. Mm-hmm. I was using a service here in the city, Amazon Prime Now, where they get it to you in like 2 hours. They nice. Didn't have that book, but they were like, but we do have. And it was this brand new book called The Body Keeps the Score, which if you know this book, you'll know that now it's been on the bestseller list for like
4,000 years. Right.
And so this was Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score. And it came in 2 hours, probably with like some ice cream and batteries or something. I don't know. Who knows? Like random stuff that you got delivered. And I read this book. it's a dense book. It's a book about trauma and how trauma shows up in the body and in the brain. And really, it gets into the physiology of trauma and how that ripples out into somebody's life, as well as body-based modalities to consider for treating trauma. I am reading this like I'm reading a murder mystery.
Page turner.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I'm seeing myself for the first time, all the stuff that I thought was weird. I thought I had kind of become this monster. I was very irritable. I was mean. I was cutting everybody out, trying to turn myself into a machine. Like I knew that that wasn't right. me, but that was me now. So like, and I didn't put it like mapped it all out and showed me like what part of my brain had
wow.
changed.
Oh, I'm getting this book.
And so I just felt like, and then it presents treatments, right? And I was like, oh, I can do something about this.
It must have been so empowering right there.
It was. And so my focus, I started to look for people who understood trauma to help me. And that was a slog. It wasn't always easy. I did find people though who maybe didn't fully understand, but were open to learning. So that was really good. And while all that's going on, I'm trying to get movement back in my life because I do know at its core, when I do it the way I was doing it before, mm-hmm. that it was wonderfully empowering. And there was a reason I wanted it in my life because there is a reason I felt safe when I was doing it, right? There was good stuff in there. So I tried things. I tried yoga. By that point, I had actually had many, many years of a regular yoga experience, but it was very triggering for me. And even the trauma-informed, trauma-sensitive stuff, which is not to say there's nothing wrong. It just wasn't for me. And I wanted to be very clear about that. And I knew that I felt safest in these barbell clubs. That's where I felt safe. So I needed to figure out how to train, how to start moving my body in a way. I started from the bottom before. Mm-hmm. How can I get strong enough and take care of my body and train going forward in a way that's going to honor my nervous system, where it is at any given moment.
That's huge.
And I started to figure it out. And then like many people who go through something, the next sort of thing was, I want to share this with people.
Right.
And that is how that happens.
That's cool. So I can imagine while listening to you talk that being stuck in your trauma and being mm-hmm. stuck in PTSD and being stuck in like ruminating over all of that negative pain, et cetera, gets you, because I've been there mm-hmm. in my own way, gets you really stuck in your head.
Oh, yes.
And there was a portion of time, X number of years, I don't exactly know, where I sort of envisioned my body as like a vehicle for my brain. You know, mm-hmm. that my body wasn't really connected to my brain. It was just the car that my brain was in. I still fight that because so much of what I do is cerebral, is intellectual, mm-hmm. and I'm not sporty. I'm not athletic by nature. And yet when I do sort of force myself into some sort of regular, irregular exercise, movement, something, mm-hmm. I feel like I can feel like more grounded and more balanced and more calm just for having moved.
Absolutely.
But I forget that, like when absolutely. I'm not doing it, you know?
I get it. I had a conversation with a friend of mine, Jennifer, who had actually one of the editors on my book. I was panicking because I've had this like very busy, I had this really busy summer into fall, lots of plates spinning, lots of things going on. So lots of brain, right?
Right.
And I'm talking to my friend Jennifer and I was like, I'm really scared. My writing practice is really like, I'm not writing. And I was writing daily, all the time, poetry, all sorts of stuff. And like, I just,
you were so busy. How much bandwidth could you have?
Well, but I wanted it. And I was like, what happened? And she said, well, I feel almost silly bringing this up to you, but it sounds like maybe you're really in your head, because you would have to be to manage all of those things. Mm-hmm. And you're not in your body. And maybe you want to do a practice that gets you in your body. And because I always would write in the morning,
right?
First thing in the morning. And then she gave me examples of what she does. And I was like, of course. She felt right. silly saying it to me, because that's what I tell people all the time, right? Is like, in right. order
physician
to live our
heal
full
myself.
Lives.
Right.
Exactly.
the Not creative that we're doctors, stuff. Just saying that.
Right. The creative work I have done, like around, you know, a lot of people write about their trauma, you know, in order to really do this in a safe and way that you process it and that you help the reader also stay with you, mm-hmm. you have to come from a grounded place. And I said, I have those things. And like, why can't I write? Because you're in your brain.
Right.
Yeah.
So what did you do? Like meditation, stretching, calisthenics?
Honestly,
what did you do?
First, I gave myself permission to not write.
Okay. We're all
that
about permission
first.
Here. The
and
the
then,
podcast.
Right? Exactly. And then I was like, okay. And I have been... My training shifted over the summer and it was a little more like general fitness. Mm-hmm. So I could play, it was a lot about helping me so I could try tennis, which I had a blast doing. I'm very bad at it. It's fun. Doesn't matter that
it's
bad.
It's fun
at
even
it.
If you suck. Yeah.
Right. But you want to protect shoulder health and with my back history, like to be able to like do something weird with my body and to not worry. Right. You know,
right.
So it's a different. I didn't have access to a barbell over the summer either. So it was just a very different way of training. It was hiking and like, I just wasn't doing heavy lifting, mm-hmm. lifting heavy things. And I have
lifting
shifted my
things.
Attention. Exactly. I shifted my attention in my training also in the last 2 weeks to really focus on like squat, press and pull like heavy weight again, back in the barbell, back in the squat rack. And it's already made a huge difference. And I wrote the essay I had been trying to write all summer. I mean, I wrote all summer. I wrote all this other stuff. I finally wrote the first draft of this essay that has been plaguing me for 2 years earlier this week.
Mazel tov.
Lifting heavy things is what I did to get back in my body.
Well, there you go. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So a client comes to you. Mm. Where do you begin? How do you help him or her unravel or them? Sorry, him, her, or them. I have to get with the pronouns. How do you help them begin to figure out where to begin?
Sure. I mean, if somebody's coming to me specifically, they probably want a strength. So But there are times where people, I do work with people in sort of more like workshop-y ways where it's like, well, they're not necessarily predisposed to strength train, but we start by figuring out what it is they might want to try. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, and this is but if somebody comes to me, they want to strength train. Similarly, I start by getting to know their resources, their goals, their strengths.
Physical resources, emotional resources, mental resources, all of it.
All of it. So resources, lots of things, resources like time and money. Also, I ask who in your life supports you and champions your small successes.
Okay. That's huge.
That's an important resource to know. Do you have a pet? What's their name? Right. That's a question I ask. That is a resource. Do you have a spiritual practice? That can mm-hmm. be a resource. I'm getting a full picture of this person's life, all the sort of good juicy stuff. You know, are there or communities that they're a part of? Anything that is a source of support. So that can be relationships. Mm-hmm. It can be objects. It can be feelings they get from doing certain things, things they love to do. So that's part, and very similar to resources is strengths. And I don't just mean like things you're good at, but things that you can call upon when things are hard. Mm-hmm. Right. So I was talking about
resilience, stubbornness. Right.
Right. That like grinding thing
Yeah.
that I do. That's actually, that's a strength. I can
Grit.
Rely on that.
Yeah.
And I know that that translates well to the strength training, right? So what are those things for the person? What are their goals, right? It's important that we're working on their goals, not anyone else's goals. Certainly not my goals, but also not their partner's goals, their doctor's goals. You know, like,
it has to be personal to them, unique to them. Yeah.
So that's all part of the like typical intake stuff, like injury history and anything like that. A lot of people don't realize that even a sprained ankle when you were 13 can show up when you're 50. So these are just things to know, for me to know. And so getting to know their body and getting to know their nervous system, just even by being with them, talking to them, and movement assessment. Sure. And that's where we start.
I love that, I mean, you talk about this from the very beginning of the book, that although lots of your clients may come to you with past trauma, you don't have any pressure for them to disclose what that was. It's just enough to know that it was there, and let's move from there. You know, that you don't have to, which I think is so respectful and so compassionate. I was really taken by surprise by that in a very loving, generous, wonderful way. You know, I just think that that's wonderful.
One of the things that I caught on from the Body Keeps the Score book at the very beginning was that, and then would deepen my sort of knowledge of, was this idea that the trauma is not the narrative. It's not what happened. The trauma is the imprint, right? It's what's going on now. Like, that's what we're working with. Now, in order to do healing around the trauma, you have to confide in somebody, a trusted person who's going to really meet you in that space and hear you and see you, witness that. But you don't need to tell everybody.
Your trauma.
Exactly. And I think especially when you're in treatment, it's really easy to start to feel like you are your trauma.
Sure.
Like I'm going to therapy 4 days a week talking about it. Like, it's pretty consuming. So this is an opportunity. If I am working with the physiology of somebody, I am noticing their physiology and I'm helping them with that. I don't need to know the story that led to it.
Right.
Because I'm not helping them process the story. And it gives them the opportunity to get in their body and do some self-care work and separate from the trauma story.
Yeah.
Have a little space. Remember that I am all of these things, not just my trauma story. So it's a break.
That's
from
huge.
That. Yeah.
That's huge. So walk us through, I want you to tell everybody about the structure of your book, which I find really wonderful. And one of the reasons why people have to go out and get themselves a copy of this. And the link to it will be in the show notes. So scroll down. If you're not driving, scroll down and just click on it and buy one now.
Absolutely. I agree. So the structure. Yeah.
It's very interesting.
It's laid out in three parts. And the first one is conditions. The second part is activation. And the third part is recovery. And then within each, there are chapters. The chapters generally open with what I realized I really liked to write. I kind of knew, but like finally admitted publicly, you know, a little bit of personal narrative. And that's what they usually open with. And then we get into more research and information. And then there's always a practical exercise towards the end. And by exercise, I don't mean like a bicep curl. I mean, sometimes it's sense-based, a meditation. It might be a physical action, a writing prompt. And these are all sort of structured to take you along. So by the end of the book, if you are interested in taking on an embodied movement practice, you are sort of set up with some basic tools to do that and have a place to start.
Yeah.
And then the reason those sections are there is that is actually how I think about a single workout, how I think about a workout program, and how I think about healing, right? Which is, we need to set the conditions first. By that, I mean, what do we need to feel safe? What do we actually need, you know, practically speaking, in terms of a workout, like, what do we need to work out? What equipment do I need? What time of day does it need to be? What kind of community or culture do I need from the place I'm doing this in? These are all like really valid and important questions that you want to ask and think about when you're trying to pick something that you can sustain. Hopefully this will be enough that you can sustain, you know, even when you like don't necessarily feel like going to the gym that day, but you don't fall off the wagon, right? Like right. People, how many of us have unused gym memberships and treadmills?
I have one right now.
Treadmills that are closets, yeah. Clothes on it. Right. So how can we like,
I have a whole gym system in my basement that functions right now as a cat gymnasium.
The cats lucky cat.
The cats play on them. A rowing machine that I can no longer use because I herniated L5 and I can't do that movement anymore. And a treadmill that I've had since the year of the flood that the cats, I don't even know what they do on it. It's, you know, whatever.
I will tell you that my back injuries all come from herniated discs in my lumbar spine.
Ah, there you go.
And I do a lot of rowing. So it is possible. Yeah, that's my favorite form of cardio.
I love the way a rowing machine feels. That's
great.
That whole stretching movement. Mm-hmm. I love that. So maybe with the Pilates, I'll strengthen my back more and I'll be able to actually do it.
So, Pilates is wonderful for the trunk. So that's conditions. Activation, right? That's like your blood's pumping. Mm-hmm. You're doing your workout, right? And in the book, I'm also talking about fundamental to the way I approach strength training is embodied movement, which I also talk about as mindful movement. I think more people are familiar with mindfulness. Mm-hmm. So like a moving meditation, right? And we think of like, oh, yoga, when done correctly, oftentimes
it can be meditative. Absolutely.
Yeah. But you can do that. You can actually turn anything into a mindfulness moment. And so that's a huge part of the strength training, my approach to strength training. And I really get into why and how that helps support trauma healing as well, how that shows up in the rest of your life. And that's with recovery, the end of a workout, maybe you do a cool down as Jane Fonda calls it. And I've got my ode to the Jane Fonda at home workout is in there. It's my favorite.
That was my jam in the 80s, man. I had the shiny tights and the belted leotard and the leg warmers, and I did the whole Jane Fonda workout thing. And
so good. So
I found
good.
My ass for the first time when I was like 14, 15 years old. And suddenly I could wear like a shorter skirt that was like a sweater knit kind of thing. And
sure.
I could not do that before. And I was like, wow, is that my ass? Wow. Thanks, Jane.
Thanks, Jane Fonda.
It was on a copy of a copy on a VHS tape that I got from somebody. And
It's all available online now. Officially, like you can get all of her workouts, even the original, the 1982 original, you can watch them on your computer. You can do it along. I mean, a friend of mine, when I was helping me, my writing coach actually, who was helping me with the book, she early on in COVID, she took it upon herself to like do a variety of all of these like home workouts, I think in part because of the book. And she did this one. She was like, it was a blast. It was a trip.
Yeah.
And I definitely dabbled in it as well as I was doing my research for the book. Mm-hmm. So yeah. So, you know, we're preparing our body, that cool down, doing things at the end of the workout to prepare your body for rest and recovery is really important. And I talk about alternatives for people who struggle with stillness. It's very important. And that was actually, I struggle with stillness, which was one of the reasons I struggled with trauma-informed yoga. Mm-hmm. So how can we find rest when we struggle with stillness?
Right? Yeah, that's I don't a big know how part to sit still. Work.
So that's really an important piece is you don't have to sit still to recover. And then also in that recovery section is a look at how this stuff spills out into the rest of your life, right? Into your relationships and things like boundaries and knowing your boundaries and enforcing your boundaries. That's all part of this work. And so that's all.
You know, I didn't actually figure out what a boundary was.
Sure.
Until my mid-40s.
Everybody's like, know your boundaries, enforce your boundaries.
And I'm like, what are you talking about? The fences around my property? Like, what do you mean boundaries? And then I heard somebody, I don't know who it was, say, boundary is simply knowing what's okay and what's not okay. And I was like, oh, shit, that's it? That's what the whole thing is?
But the thing is that
they're so hard to figure out and enforce.
And if what gets overlooked is like, know your boundaries and practice enforcing them. But like, okay, so how do I know what's okay and what's not okay? If you are very disconnected and you're living in here and you've got a whole bunch of social rules dictating everything, and you don't want to, you're a people pleaser maybe, or whatever. It's very hard if your body is telling you things, but if you're disconnected from it, you don't know it. And so that is like, I'm always like, yeah, no, it's great. Boundaries are great. Listening to your boundaries is great, but you have to know how to hear them. Right. You have to have access to them, and that you get from your body.
You have to have access to them. But besides even knowing what they are, and that's huge to figure out, having the agency to enforce them,
right,
not being afraid to say, no, this isn't comfortable. I don't like this. I'm not happy here, or I'm not doing that, or you're not coming here, or whatever it is. I think I figured out what some subset of my boundaries were before I had the chutzpah to enforce them.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was still too afraid of someone saying, you're not worth my time or energy to deal with that level of stuff. I'm out of here.
Absolutely.
And I had to come to terms with the fact that I'm perfectly fine with you in my life, and I'm perfectly fine without you in my life. So if you don't do it on my terms, get the fuck out.
Exactly. It's hard. It's really hard to say that if you haven't been.
I was in my
that.
Late. I'm only 53 now. I was in my late 40s before I had the chutzpah to do that.
I think
to protect myself. It's hard shit.
It's hard. You got there, and I see. I had some experiences prior to the second back injury, so just when I was doing weightlifting for love, where I was tired of my boundaries being violated in the gym. So this was all in the gym, just like icky stuff I didn't like anymore, right? Like, it's kind of a gross culture sometimes. And from feeling so strong and feeling capable, and also knowing when I was at my edge, right? I had been strength training to a point where I was like, oh, okay, that's it. That was the last rep, because I could feel my physical edge. Mm-hmm. I started to notice my physical edge when people would tick me off, when people would say things that I didn't like, that I couldn't stand by anymore. And I started to say something. And you know what? I had to leave certain gyms. There were gyms where I was like, okay, we're not going to agree. You're not going to change. Fine, I'm going to leave. And so I got practice in the gym, and I realized that I could help people practice in the gym. I think it's really important when you work in sort of any healing arts to have clear boundaries as the practitioner, mm-hmm, for yourself and also for your clients. It helps them feel better, and it mirrors something to them that, like, it's okay. You can be kind and compassionate and warm and caring and have boundaries. And also,
like, I remember you said at some point in your book that you ask permission before touching a client's body to help them get into position or to help show them what the movement was, but that you weren't just going to touch someone without asking permission. And I thought, that's freaking awesome.
And I'm not just going to listen to their words. I'm going to watch their body. Right?
Right.
So there's a difference here, right? Like, if somebody's like, yeah, sure, their shoulders go up to their ears.
Maybe not.
Their head is saying yes, right? So this is what we were talking about.
Right.
Their head is like, oh, I don't want to upset her.
Right.
Whatever. I want to be easy. I don't want to be difficult. Saying yes or yes, but their body has told me an entirely different story. And I'm like, or why don't we try this? And I redirect with a verbal cue, right?
Right.
And that's a really important thing, and that it changes, right? There are a lot of practitioners or a lot of people who will say, like, oh yeah, it's always fine. And I like to leave room. Maybe they always say, okay, I try. And I will say, like, to any, if anybody's listening who's doing, you know, this kind of work, it's like, oh, I want to start doing that. I mess up sometimes and forget to ask, like, I make mistakes and I apologize. But so I try, especially with clients who say, like, oh, it's always okay, to check in anyway. And I say, I'm going to ask. It's an opportunity for you to check in and make sure it really is. Because it changes all the time. Changes with our partners and people we love and who we're physical with.
Not in the
with.
Mood sometimes to be bothered, like, sometimes.
Don't touch me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. So big takeaways from the book. What do you want? What was the goal to have people understand?
First, I wanted to connect with people, right? So I had that experience of reading The Body Keeps the Score. And I wanted other people to feel seen.
Yes.
It, and honestly, like I also got to be seen, right? So that, yeah. Which was nice. So there was that. That was sort of a quieter thing. That's not a big takeaway, but that was one of my takeaways.
Of course.
And then one of the big things is that you can use movement to help you thrive and have a fulfilling life. It doesn't have to be about all the things we tend to make it about, mm-hmm. getting better at something, getting smaller, getting bigger, maybe if you want to be more muscular. It's not even about performance. It can be, but like, it can also just be like, my writing practice is really suffering.
Right. Well, that's a beautiful lesson there. Yeah.
So movement.
And like your mom, you just want to tie your shoes when you get older, you know?
Right. Absolutely. So that is a big part of it. I think also that any movement practice, this is a big part of the book, any movement practice can be turned into a healing movement practice.
Mm-hmm. I think just by focusing inward on what the body is doing and getting yourself out of your head and not focusing on everything around you helps. I know that helps me feel more grounded and more in the moment and more in my body, whether I'm moving whatever part of my body, especially like in this new Pilates practice that I've been mm-hmm. doing, like I'm focusing on the actual movement and the alignment of my body and what body parts going where and where feet are pointing. And because that all matters, who the hell knew, but that all matters. Right. And just the movement itself and how does it feel and where is my elbow and let's breathe. And what I didn't know about Pilates also, and I think I was probably doing it wrong all those years I was doing mat Pilates by myself, is it matters what the inhalation and exhalation matters as to what part of the movement it's coordinated with. Mm-hmm. And I think I had always sort of just naturally done it backwards from what the instructor says. And so like when you push away, that's the exhale. And when you're pushing, when you're I don't know how to, I'm not a fitness person, so I can't explain that, but
it varies from
on all of those things, yeah. Makes it very mindful and meditative for me.
Yes. Yes. You are coming home to your body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were you saying about not that cut you off?
Oh, I was going to say it varies from modality to modality. That's why I wasn't like, oh, it's this one. I didn't want to misspeak about Pilates. I am not a Pilates instructor.
Yeah. No, nor am I.
But yes, it's coming home to your body and not something like Pilates on the reformer. You're not looking in a mirror. You're turning inwards and feeling your body.
Yeah. I love that.
And that's what I mean. Obviously plenty of gyms have a bajillion mirrors in the free weight section. I work out at home now ever since COVID. I don't have mirrors and historically, one of the reasons, even when I wasn't training with a barbell, would train in barbell clubs because mm-hmm. they usually have free weights in there too, so they tend not to have mirrors everywhere. And it's really about not, because if you try to watch yourself do a movement, you're going to mess up your form because your eyes are going to be.
We're in the wrong place.
Your neck do things, right?
Right.
This is really about feeling the internal experience. Like you said, is my elbow in the right place? Is my breathing pattern in the correct order? You're feeling these things. And that's so, that's giving you access. That's practicing feeling your body during stress. Exercise is stressful. Even if you're enjoying it, it's stressful. And so
and painful sometimes.
Right. So then when you're having a heartbreaking argument, something that is also painful and stressful, you can come into your body for a moment and go, hey, what's going on in here? Where are my boundaries? What do they feel like?
Right. Right. I could get through that. I'm going to get through this. I know where my limits are. I know where the edges are.
Right. And I can do it. I can be okay. And I can come into my body, even though it's uncomfortable, and get all that information.
And that's huge.
Yes.
Yeah. For someone who used to envision her body as a car, that's huge.
Most of my friends think of themselves as brains in a jar. So I understand.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm an English teacher. So I teach with other people who are all intellectually stuck that way too. And most of us are around the same age. Mm-hmm. I tend to be a little older, but around the same age. And we're all sort of facing the same issues. So there's a lot of talking and camaraderie and, oh, you can do it. Like, oh, that's so exciting. You know, it's a nice little cheering section. It's awesome.
Love that.
So your book is available anywhere books are sold. This has been lovely, Laura. Thank you so much for being here and giving us another way to give ourselves permission to heal. Excellent. Yay. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. I have an offer for you that you likely can't refuse. If you liked this episode and you would like a copy of Laura Kudari's book, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and I will raffle off a copy of her book to someone who leaves a review. Easy peasy. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Permission to Heal. I hope you found it moving and inspirational. Please remember, you don't need anyone else's permission to trust and follow your heart. You have the power within you. Subscribe to Permission to Heal so you don't miss any new episodes, and please share this with your friends.